Voice of America in Washington. This is VOA Global for November 11th, 2014. I'm Jim Stevenson.
I'm Ira Melman. On our program today, President Obama tells Chinese business leaders that the United States is entirely committed to Asia. Also announces a new visa policy with China.
That's big. We'll examine what's been described as an icy meeting between the leaders of China and Japan on some highly controversial issues.
Security researchers have uncovered a sophisticated industrial espionage campaign that targets business executives in luxury hotels across Asia. We'll hear more when we check Asia Business News.
And with Ira in the American Cafe, we'll hear about a growing forest in an urban town near Washington, D.C., all coming up on VOA Global. This is Daybreak Asia, a summary of Asian news and events for Tuesday, November 11th. I'm Jim Stevenson. In brief today, the annual APEC summit is underway in Beijing, and President Obama makes an announcement that our Chinese listeners will definitely want to know about concerning travel visas to the United States. First, President Barack Obama received a warm welcome in China, despite tensions on issues like trade, human rights, and China's territorial claims in the East and South China Seas. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez is traveling with the U.S. president and has more.
President Barack Obama knew this would not be an easy trip. Relations between the two countries have been strained in large part because of Chinese suspicions that the United States wants to contain China's growth. But both sides appeared wanting to accentuate the positive aspects of their relationship. Chinese leaders welcomed Mr. Obama at Beijing Airport Monday with an honor guard and red carpet. Later, Mr. Obama addressed business leaders at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. Dispelling Chinese suspicions topped his agenda.
The United States welcomes the rise of a prosperous, peaceful, and stable China. I want to repeat that. We welcome the rise of a prosperous, peaceful, and stable China. In fact, over recent decades, the United States has worked to help integrate China into the global economy, not only because it's in China's best interest, but because it's in America's best interest and the world's best interest. We want China to do well.
Deepening relations with China, Mr. Obama said, will mean more jobs and opportunity for the American and Chinese people. The U.S. leader announced a new agreement to extend the validity of visas for students, business people, and tourists.
Under the current arrangement, visas between our two countries last for only 1 year. Under the new arrangement, student and exchange visas will be extended to 5 years. Business and tourist visas will be extended to 10 years.
But the U.S. and China are far from agreeing on thorny issues like human rights, cyberspace, and trade. Washington and Beijing are pursuing rival trade deals. The APEC summit is a chance for President Obama to rally Asia-Pacific nations to overcome obstacles to approve the long-delayed Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. The U.S. leader gathered heads of state of 11 countries at the American Embassy in Beijing and urged them to get past what he said are remaining logjams. On human rights, Mr. Obama refrained from condemning China for its behavior in Hong Kong, where demonstrators for months have accused Beijing of violating its commitment to not interfere in the autonomous region's democratic process. The U.S. leader, however, said he remains concerned about what he described as a situation that is historically complicated. Monday was the start of Mr. Obama's 3-day visit to Beijing for the APEC summit and meetings with Chinese President Xi Jinping. On Wednesday, he will travel to Myanmar, also known as Burma, before going to the G20 summit in Australia. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, Beijing.
As you just heard in our report from Beijing, Mr. Obama announced a new visa policy with China. It's one that will increase the validity of short-term tourist and business visas issued to one another's citizens from 1 to 10 years. That's the longest validity allowed under U.S. law. And it also extends the validity of student and exchange visas from 1 to 5 years. The new agreement goes into effect virtually immediately tomorrow, November 12th.
Chinese President Xi Jinping is acknowledging that new problems exist in Beijing's relations with Taiwan, a self-ruled island that China hopes to claim as its own someday. Ralph Jennings reports for VOA in Taipei.
When Chinese President Xi Jinping met a Taiwanese delegation at an annual regional economic meeting, he noted new problems in relations and urged that both sides do more to improve ties for the long term. At the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum in Beijing Sunday, Chinese state media reported that Mr. Xi said that although it is unavoidable that the two sides would have differences, they must respect each other's choice of development path and social system. China has claimed sovereignty over Taiwan since the 1940s and wants to reunify despite opposition on the self-ruled island. Since 2008, China has signed 21 economic deals with Taiwan as an incentive to merge. But anti-China protests in Taiwan, a long-delayed trade liberalization deal, and the standoff over democratic reforms in Hong Kong have taken a toll on China-Taiwan relations. In recent months, Taiwan's President Ma Ying-jeou also urged Beijing to agree to protesters' demands in Hong Kong for universal suffrage for the territory's chief executive. Ralph Jennings, VOA News, Taipei.
While APEC is dominating news from Asia this week, we'd like to tell you about two Americans who were imprisoned in North Korea. They have enjoyed their second day of freedom back here in the United States after they were released Saturday following a trip to Pyongyang by the director of U.S. National Intelligence, James Clapper. VOA's Victor Beatty reports the release of 46-year-old Kenneth Bay and 24-year-old Matthew Todd Miller came just weeks after a third American was suddenly freed from captivity.
A grateful Kenneth Bay of Linwood, Washington, spoke briefly about his two-year ordeal on his arrival late Saturday aboard a U.S. government plane at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, south of Seattle.
I just want to say thank you all for supporting me, lifting me up, and not forgetting me. At the same time that I also not forgetting the people of North Korea. It's been amazing 2 years. I learned a lot. I grew a lot. Lost a lot of weight in a good way. But I'm standing strong because of you.
Bae, a Korean-American missionary and tour guide, was serving a 15-year sentence for alleged anti-government activities. Miller of Bakersfield, California, was detained in April after he allegedly tore up his visa and demanded asylum. He was sentenced to 6 years in prison for hostile acts against the state. The North released 56-year-old tourist Jeffrey Fole of Miamisburg, Ohio, October 22nd, after his arrest in May for leaving a Bible behind in a nightclub. He was awaiting trial. Stanford University Korea expert David Straub says Pyongyang has long wanted to resolve the issue of the imprisoned Americans, and the timing of the release may be intentional, coinciding with the regional APEC summit in China.
By releasing these three men, the North Koreans have taken away a talking point for the Obama administration when he sees the Chinese leaders trying to get North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons program. Another possibility is that the North Koreans are trying to get the United States to go a little easier on them on the human rights issue.
A non-binding draft resolution prepared for the General Assembly by the European Union and Japan will recommend a lengthy report by a UN Commission of Inquiry be referred to the International Criminal Court, including targeted sanctions against those responsible for crimes against humanity. A vote could take place this month. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Glad we could spend some time together today. Daybreak Asia comes to you every weekday on VOA Global and as a podcast to which you may subscribe for free at voanews.com.
This is VOA Global. They told us to make this interactive, so the way we do that is to ask you to talk to us about what you think about what we are doing. That's called interactivity, and we had an old poll, now we have a new poll.
That's right. I mean, there are a lot of ways that you can get in touch with us here at The Voice of America. You can write to us, VOA Asia at voanews.com. You can post some of your comments to our stories on our website, and we can you can also look at one of our polls and vote how you think you depending on what the poll question is. Let's get that out. That's at voanews.com/Asia. We just had a poll that closed that asked, how should Hong Kong authorities respond to the protests? Almost 60% of you said they should hold talks with the protesters and respond to their demands. About 18% said clear the streets of the protesters and return the city to normal. 17% wanted just to wait out the protests without taking any measures. About 6% were not sure. We have a brand new poll for you to vote in. Ira, what's that
all
about?
Here's the question for you in our new poll just opening right now. You are the first to know what the poll is asking. It is, what do you think the APEC summit meetings will do to improve U.S.-China and China-Japan relations? And here are your choices. Number one, or A, this will prompt long-term positive change. B, this won't fix anything. C, there is potential for positive relations, but we have to wait and see. And D, you're unsure about the entire thing.
We're waiting for your votes. All you have to do is go to our website, voanews.com/Asia. That's one of the many ways you can get in touch with us. We'd love to hear your comments and see how you vote.
That's your interactivity segment, and we really do want to hear from you. Please do so.
This is VOA Global.
Yes.
We have so many shows and programs, I had to decide which one it is. Jim Stevenson, along with Ira Melman. We've got some good stuff coming up for you.
Francis Alonzo will check in immediately with Women Rising. A very interesting story about where it is safe for women to travel around the world, and she'll talk about that.
And coming up, news from China and the APEC summit.
All on VOA Global.
Welcome to this edition of Voice of America's Women Rising. I'm your host, Frances Alonzo. The Thomson Reuters Foundation has released a poll that puts South and East Asia in the top 10 least safe transportation systems for women. Of the 15 largest capitals in the world, Delhi is at number 4 and Jakarta comes in at number 5 as the top cities in Asia that are considered the most dangerous. Monique Villa is the CEO of the Thomson Reuters Foundation. She tells me the surprising thing that women want to help solve some of the problems and how other countries in Asia rank on the list.
In Asia, the interesting thing is that you could have thought that New Delhi would be among the worst in India. And indeed, it is 3 Latin American capitals which are the worst, namely Bogota, Mexico, and Lima, in that order. And Delhi, Jakarta, and Kuala Lumpur, Bangkok come after. And Manila is immediately after Paris, the 7th best. So Asia is better than Latin America, which doesn't mean that it is all lovely. New Delhi, on many fronts, has been less difficult to live in when you are a woman than Bogota or Mexico. Beijing and Tokyo are the first ones. I mean, it's in that order. New York, Tokyo, Beijing, London, Seoul, Paris. So that's the best city for transport, where women feel safe in the tube or on buses. What was really interesting is that to see that today New York comes first, where 25 years ago it was one of the worst, and you would never walk at night alone in New York if you were a woman. Tokyo was also a very difficult city for women because the transports are packed. You remember these images of being pushed into the tube and the doors would not close. So the promiscuity, which is always a very big issue because it allows a lot of bad behaviors from men. So Tokyo was quite in a very bad position 15 years ago. And then they decided to create the women-only carriages. And it seems that it has improved considerably the situation in Tokyo. This is not to say that it's a good solution, because I think it's like a band-aid on an issue. You don't solve the problem. But obviously, it has made women feel much more secure.
What can world leaders take away from this particular study to improve their city public transportation system?
If you just look at what was the situation in New York, for instance, 25 years ago, where you were afraid to travel alone at night in the tube, etc., and what it is today, you see that many measures that have been taken have been going in the right direction. That is to say, put an end to impunity against these, you know, crimes that many consider very petty crimes. It's nothing, don't care, you've been groped, and so what? So from the moment the impunity stops, people start to be more careful. The other factor has certainly been also all the CCTVs and cameras everywhere in the system, which makes that, you know, people know that they will be found out. And then, you know, of course, you have the culture also.
In your mind, what stands out about this particular study?
Big surprise was that so many women said, yes, we would love to have women's only carriages. In Manila, it was 94% of the women. In Jakarta, Mexico, Delhi, it was very, very high level, much lower level in London, Paris, or New York. So that was something which was really striking for me, that as they don't see any solution, they say, at least put us among women and we will not have that problem any longer, which, as we know, doesn't solve the root of the problem. And the other thing that struck me was the very high numbers of women who think that nobody will move a finger if they see them attack in the same carriage where they are. I think it's amazing, and it's a sign of our time.
That was Monique Villa, the CEO of the Thomson Reuters Foundation. You can read the full results of the poll at www.trust.org. You can read a transcript of this interview and check out other podcasts of Women Rising at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonso. Thank you for joining me on Women Rising.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. The leaders of China and Japan met Monday at the APEC summit in Beijing in an attempt to reduce tensions between the two countries. VOA's Brian Padden reports from our North Asia Bureau.
Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and Chinese President Xi Jinping met briefly at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum in Beijing Monday. They briefly shook hands for photographers and spoke behind closed doors for about 30 minutes in their first face-to-face meeting since coming to power. The talks are meant to symbolize new efforts being made by both sides to reduce the potential for military conflict following 2 years of high tensions. After the meeting, the Japanese Prime Minister said both countries had begun to work towards reconciliation. He says it was the first step to return to the basics and improve ties to develop a mutually beneficial relationship. Chinese state media reported that President Xi called on Japan to play a constructive role in safeguarding the region's peace and stability. In a joint statement released Friday, the two sides agreed to gradually resume political, diplomatic, and security dialogue and make efforts to build political mutual trust. The agreement subtly navigates one of the major obstacles for talks, how each side describes the territorial disputes over a group of islands called the Diaoyus in China and the Senkakus in Japan. Japan refuses to acknowledge any challenge to its sovereignty over the islands, insisting they belong to Tokyo. Hosaka Yuji, a political science professor at Sejong University, says the carefully worded agreement, stating that different positions exist on the dispute, was a compromise by both sides. He says China asked Japan to accept that the Senkaku Islands are a regional dispute, but this part was not included in the agreement. Instead, it ended in an expression saying there is a different perspective on this issue. Hosaka says Japan contends that it has made the best concession it can make, while China sees it as the second best agreement it could get. Mr. Abe's visit to a controversial World War II shrine that includes some Japanese war criminals also contributed to the high tensions with China, as well as worsening ties with South Korea. U.S. officials regularly say they welcome China's rise as a global power and have no intentions of trying to contain Beijing. Brian Padden, VOA News, Seoul.
Jen Wong is professor of diplomacy and international relations at Seton Hall University in New Jersey. He tells VOA's Michael Lippin about the implications of the meeting.
If we talk about what is driving these two countries to make this change, I think there's a couple of reasons. First is this actually belongs to their national interest, because both countries, the two countries, they have a very high level of economic interdependence. And what they did in the recent several years was actually basically against their national interest because of the rising of the nationalism, because of the historic issues. And actually, the business circles in both countries were quite unhappy with this bad relationship. Second is that there exists the real danger of conflict, especially the concerns about accidents or emergency incident that happened that could escalate quickly from a small incident into a major conflict. You know, one of the agreement they reached is that the two countries will establish a kind of mechanism to talk about crisis management, because this is basic meaningless and foolish if the conflict between the two countries is actually caused by escalation of a small incident or some accidental issues. I think another reason for this four-point agreement is China sees this APEC meeting a great opportunity for its diplomacy, especially they want to use this summit to improve its relationship with neighboring countries.
Jen Wong, professor of diplomacy and international relations at Seton Hall University. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
This is VOA Global from the Voice of America. Time to check the Asia business news. Asian markets were mixed Monday, with Japanese shares bowing to profit-taking, while Hong Kong and Shanghai rallied after a launch date was announced for a trading link between their stock exchanges. The dollar retreated from multi-year highs despite another record close on Wall Street that came in response to positive job numbers. Tokyo slipped almost 100 points to finish at 16,780.5 after ramping up gains of more than 10% in the previous six sessions as the Bank of Japan unveiled fresh monetary easing measures. Hong Kong rose about 194 points, and Shanghai jumped 2.5% or 55.5 points to 2,474. Seoul closed up almost a percentage point, and Sydney fell about half a percentage point. Dealers in Hong Kong and Shanghai cheered the news that the delayed trading link between the two stock exchanges would start on November 17th. That connection expected to allow the equivalent of about $3.8 billion U.S. dollars a day in cross-border transactions. I'm Ira Melman. Jim Stevenson is here, too.
Security researchers uncovered a sophisticated industrial espionage campaign targeting business executives in luxury hotels across Asia once they sign on to computers using in-room wireless connections, which they consider private and secure. A report from Kaspersky Lab says that the attacks, which go well beyond the typical cyber criminal operations, have claimed thousands of victims dating back to 2009.
And internet investors know about Cyber Monday. Well, what about the Chinese version? And Alibaba says it is Singles Day, and it's bringing a whole bunch of business their way, celebrating Chinese being signal. That's Asia Single, rather. That's Asia Business News.
This is Today in History. On November 11, 1620, English settlers signed the Mayflower Compact, the first governing document of Plymouth Colony in Massachusetts. On this day in 1831, Nat Turner, the leader of a slave revolt in the southern U.S. state of Virginia, was hanged after killing dozens of people during a failed rebellion. At the 11th hour, on the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918, the First World War officially came to an end. In 1965, Rhodesia, modern-day Zimbabwe, declared its independence from Britain. In 1966, the Methodist Church and the Evangelical United Brethren Church approved a constitution for a new United Methodist Church. In 1983, U.S. President Ronald Reagan became the first U.S. president to address Japan's legislature. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Well, today in Asia, as Ira mentioned, and China specifically, it's Singles Day. If you think about how 11-11 looks, how it, the numbers appear. It looks like two people next to each other, singles, and that's how they came up with Singles Day.
But what does it mean sociologically?
Well, it means that people buy a lot of stuff for other singles, and you know, Alibaba's cashing in on that along with other online retailers and even, you know, the brick-and-mortar stores.
$2 billion for Alibaba within the first hour of local holiday Singles Day.
Wouldn't you like to have a cut of that?
Shares of Alibaba soared on the New York Stock Exchange. And, you know, anything you do business-wise in China, you got a lot of business coming your way.
You do. We're going to check out the latest world news coming up next with Steve Norman and International Edition right here on VOA Global.
And now, VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a deadly bombing in Nigeria. Is the Islamic State's leader dead, wounded, or alive after last week's airstrike? Plus, Asia-Pacific leaders meeting at a resort outside of Beijing. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Dozens of people are dead after a bomb blast hit a school in Nigeria's restive Yobe State. The extremist group Boko Haram is suspected to be behind that blast. Chris Stein has more from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
A suicide bomber targeted students gathered for a morning assembly at the Senior Science Secondary School in the town of Potiskum, killing at least 48 people and leaving 79 injured. Police say the bomber donned a school uniform to blend in among students at the all-boys school. Abubakar Issa is a teacher at the school and says the death toll is far higher. Issa says the bomber struck the morning assembly at the school, but not all the students were there when the blast happened. He says 70 students have died and another 70 injured, some of whom could not be identified. He says the Red Cross and other humanitarian groups have been helping those affected by the bomb. Potiskum is located in Yobe, one of the three states placed under a state of emergency by the government last year due to the Boko Haram insurgency. Boko Haram, whose name, roughly translated, means Western education is forbidden, has attacked schools before, most notably in April, when the group kidnapped more than 200 girls from a secondary school in the town of Chibok. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
United States has opened the first of several Ebola treatment units in its building in Liberia. New clinic is in a town called Tubmanburg, about 60 kilometers north of the Liberian capital, Monrovia. A U.S. Agency for International Development statement said up to 17 such units will be constructed in Liberia, including three that will be operated by the International Organization for Migration. According to the World Health Organization, the number of people infected with Ebola appears to be decreasing in Monrovia, the capital there, but more cases are being detected in other areas such as Tubmanburg. Since the first case of Ebola was reported in March, more than 2,700 people in Liberia have lost their lives to the deadly virus, which has taken just under 5,000 lives in total in West Africa. U.S. officials say they cannot corroborate reports that Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was killed or wounded in a U.S. airstrike in northern Iraq late Friday. U.S. State Department spokesperson Jennifer Psaki.
Coalition aircraft conducted a series of airstrikes November 7th in Iraq against what was assessed to be a gathering of ISIL leaders near Mosul, destroying a vehicle convoy consisting of 10 ISIL-armed trucks. We cannot confirm if ISIL leader Baghdadi was among those present. We have no further information to provide regarding those strikes at this point.
U.S. military spokesman Colonel Steve Warren said Monday that U.S. forces were not specifically targeting Baghdadi in the strike, but are trying to degrade the group's ability to command its forces. On Sunday, Iraq's defense minister purportedly issued a statement on his Facebook page saying that Baghdadi was wounded in the airstrike. Various other reports claim the airstrike killed one of Baghdadi's close aides. In another development on Monday, the Egyptian militant group Ansar Beit al-Baghdadi pledged its loyalty to Baghdadi. We get more now from Edward Uranian in Cairo.
In an audio message purportedly from Ansar Beit al-Maqdis, the militant group claims to have pledged its loyalty to the Islamic State and its self-proclaimed Caliph Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. The voice cites a number of verses from the Quran to support Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis' decision to support the Islamic State. It also says Islamic State and its supporters are waging a battle against what it called Jews and Crusaders. Edward Uranian, Cairo.
Palestinians carried out two attacks on Monday in Israel, killing a young woman, critically wounding a soldier. It was the latest violence over tensions at a Jerusalem holy site revered by both Muslims and Jews. The attack drew angry response from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who said Israeli Arab protesters intent on violence against Israelis, that is, should move to Palestinian enclaves in the West Bank or the Gaza Strip. Violence in Israel has escalated in recent days as tensions have increased over access to the Temple Mount, which houses Islam's third holiest site and the Jewish state's most revered locale where biblical Jewish temples once stood. Mr. Netanyahu says he has no plans to alter rules for worship at the site, but Palestinian attacks on Israelis have mounted in recent days. Stone-throwing protests erupted in several Arab towns after police killed an Arab youth who assaulted them. Israeli leader said Sunday he will not tolerate the waving of Hamas or of Islamic State militant flags in Israeli cities, which he equated with protesters calling for Israel's destruction. He raised the possibility of revoking Israeli citizenship for such demonstrators. Iran, the United States, European Union have wrapped up 2 days of talks, those taking place in Amman without any noted breakthrough on a comprehensive nuclear agreement for Tehran. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, and European Union envoy Catherine Ashton were trying to reach a deal Monday ahead of the looming November 24th deadline for a pact. Heading into Monday's evening session, Zarif voiced hope for progress, in his words, eventually. China's President Xi Jinping and his wife on Monday welcomed the Beijing leaders the leaders of 21 economies in the Asia-Pacific region, those including Japan, Russia, and the United States. Leaders gathered for a welcoming state dinner, a banquet, they say, at Water Cube, a landmark venue for the 2008 Olympics that hosted the swimming competitions. Annual APEC summit gets underway later today in a resort town near Beijing. The one-day leaders' retreat today will try to identify new engines of economic growth while providing an opportunity for much-needed diplomacy in the region. Mr. Xi and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe also held an ice-breaking meeting on Monday on the sidelines of the conference following more than 2 years of deep tensions over an island dispute. And more than 1,500 letters and writings from queens, actresses, and singers go under the gavel in Paris next week. Rarest document is the signed letter from Catherine of Aragon, the first wife of England's Henry VIII, to a Spanish cardinal pleading for the Pope's help in blocking Henry's attempt to annul their marriage because she had failed to produce a son. Rome's refusal to grant Henry a divorce led to a schism within the Roman Catholic Church as Henry appointed himself head of the Church of England. Some of the stories making news, the rest online right here at voanews.com.
This is Business News on VOA Global for November 11th. Jim Stevenson along with Ira Melman. World equity markets hit their highest level in more than a month Monday, lifted by a deal to give global investors easier access to China's $3.9 trillion stock market and more gains in U.S. equities. Wall Street ended higher, with the S&P 500 rising about 0.3%, closing a record 2,038.26 points, while the Dow Industrials gained about 0.2% to a new closing high of 17,613.
The success of the Walt Disney Company's movies, including the animated tale Frozen and the Marvel movie Guardians of the Galaxy, lifted the media company's fiscal fourth quarter results. Disney Studios has had a string of hits that's likely to continue with the first of its annual Star Wars movie launching next week. On Thursday, Disney said the movie will be called The Force Awakens.
Well, changes on the agenda for Pizza Hut. USA Today reports the pizza chain is rebooting itself for a new generation of pizza eaters. Following 2 years of disappointing sales, Pizza Hut will be focusing on dozens of new flavor options as it mounts the 56-year-old brand's biggest ever redo. It will add 11 new pizza recipes, 10 new crust flavors, 6 new sauces, 5 new toppings, 4 new flavor-packed drizzles, a new logo and new uniforms, and yes, even a new pizza box.
Yeah. Tech entrepreneur Elon Musk is in preliminary talks on the possibility of launching a fleet of 700 lightweight communication satellites that could provide internet access. Wall Street Journal reports that Musk, the founder of Space Exploration Technologies Corporation, better known as SpaceX, and Tesla Motors, is in talks with a former Google executive to build the satellites.
That's business news on VOA Global. I'm Jim Stevenson along with Ira Melman. This is VOA Global on the Voice of America. We're glad to have you with us. Ira, you know, we've got your segment, The American Cafe, coming up, and also David Byrd with Now on a moving story about veterans coming home.
Yeah, and on American Cafe, to be a forested area, you don't necessarily have to be in a rural area. That's what's all that all about, coming up just in a few seconds, right here on VOA Global. I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. If your idea of a forest is a rural area densely packed with trees, think again. A forest canopy can be grown anywhere there's room to plant a tree, even in cities. VOA's Roseanne Skirbel takes us to a community located off of a busy commuter highway near Washington, D.C., that is growing an urban forest and reaping its benefits one tree at a time.
2,400 people call Forest Heights home. Their neighborhood overlooks the highway that many of them take to work. There's no downtown or business center. What Forest Heights does have is can-do mayor Jacqueline Goodall, a woman with a vision.
My vision for our town is to be the greenest town in Maryland. Matter of fact, Forest Heights was green before green was green.
Trees are central to that vision. Today, she's enlisted 150 students from the University of Maryland to help ready a plot of land for 500 trees. They're working near an elementary school, which is located on a floodplain, to take out weeds.
And you just grab it and just start cutting it all the way to the ground like that.
Trees growing here can help protect the school grounds and nearby homes when it rains. And Goodall adds, the homeowner reaps even more benefits.
If you got a fully grown willow oak, you're going to be able to reduce your energy because it's going to provide shade in the summer. You're not going to be using as much electricity. It's going to be cutting the wind in the winter, so you're not going to have to use as much heat. No, it's going to be soaking up some of the groundwater, so you're not pumping it out into the street picking up pollutants, and your basement is flooding less.
Anne Buckaloo applauds these efforts. The U.S. Forest Service scientists stopped by to check out Mayor Goodall's progress in urban forestry.
You know, if we want to address the stormwater issue, there's things that we must do. Planting trees is one of them.
Exactly.
Educating our citizens on what they need to be doing on their property.
Buckaloo says as people begin to see trees as assets, cities become richer and more livable.
People think about forests as walking through a large area of trees, very sylvan, very much rural. But most people, 80% of the U.S., lives in an area that's considered urban. And we have 100 million acres of urban forests. And it's really important to maintain and sustain those forests, like these folks are doing here today.
Goodall started her planting campaign in 2008, when she was still just a member of the town council. The tree canopy at the time covered only 37% of Forest Heights. Since then, she's turned the municipal building into a green sanctuary and planted 1,100 street trees in front of homes. She says as they mature, they will increase property values, reduce atmospheric pollutants, and aid with stormwater retention. She calculates that's worth about $3 million to the town.
When I started this, it was just basically planting the tree because it was beautiful. The more I looked into trees, I found out what a tree could do for my community and how much value it has added to my community. So the trees are an investment, not only to our town, but they're an investment to us.
Betty Wilson has lived in Forest Heights since the mid-1980s. She admires the pink blossoms of the crepe myrtle planted in front of her house 4 years ago.
Well, it beautifies my house because I love to keep my grass pretty and I like the beautiful tree and it looks nice.
Wilson and her neighbors now live on tree-lined streets. Mayor Goodall says the initiative is raising awareness about health and the economic and ecosystem services that trees provide. Her hope is that Forest Heights lives up to its name by covering its streets with a green canopy. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
You can hear American Cafe on air and online at voanews.com and as a podcast. I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. This week, the United States marks Veterans Day, a day when we recognize those who have served in our military. But veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan face unique challenges that previous generations did not. To find out more, I spoke to Colonel David Sutherland, a U.S. Army veteran and a former special assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. What are some of the struggles that veterans are facing when they make that transition from military to civilian life?
It's not just us that serve in combat, but it's our families who are so strong, brave, and resilient, and also come home at the same time that the service member is. And the needs of both the veterans and the military families are evolving. They're not disappearing. So what we went through in challenges coming home to a disconnection in 2006, 2007, now what we're seeing in 2014 and what we'll see in the future is the needs evolving and not disappearing. And the other part is it's going to happen at a time when the wars are receding from the minds of the American people. And so that disconnect is probably what we have to look at more than anything. How do we bridge that disconnect between the military and civil society so they understand not only what we are as veterans and military families, but who we are?
How do you think the business public needs to be made aware of the unique skills that veterans have?
When I made the comment about the American people know what we are, but they may not know us, it goes to that specifically with HR professionals, understanding the skill sets that these phenomenal young men and women bring home with them. And business hailed these skills that veterans possess: accelerated learning curve, leadership, teamwork, efficient performance under pressure, respect for procedures, all of these different aspects of our culture in the military that we bring home to improve the bottom line of our businesses. And probably one of the most significant is that triumphing over adversity, recognizing their ability to deal with difficult circumstances and turn the negative into positive.
The condition post-traumatic stress disorder is mentioned a lot when discussing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, particularly because of the prevalence in those wars of IEDs and traumatic brain injury. What resources are available for veterans? I know there's a transition assistance program in the DOD, but what medical resources are available for veterans and for their families when dealing with something like that?
Life experiences don't just turn off. And the other piece is understanding that the number one remedy for dealing with the effects of these are feeling like you fit in, feeling connected, feeling like you're not different. And so it's not just the medical, removing the pathology and listening to those that have served, listening to their stories and their experiences. But then when you look at community-based services, and that's really what it comes down to. Community-based services, not necessarily creating new programs, but taking what exists already within the VA, within departments and agencies, faith-based organizations, healthcare providers across the country where nurses and doctors will ask the patient, did you serve? And then recognize the impact of that combat experience on them, and are they moving on with life? Are they socializing and being part of life? Those are the challenges, and then creating that no wrong door approach locally.
There are, in both of these wars, a unique number of female veterans that are coming back and making that transition from the front lines to the home front. What do you think are some of the unique struggles that women face when they get back home?
We have to be open, honest, and candid and realize that, again, their challenges are unique, and we have to address those at the community-based level with services that already exist, harnessing those existing community-based services and then tying those to all that have served, but recognizing the unique needs of our female veterans.
To read the full interview, log on to our website, www.voanews.com. Until next time, I'm David Berg.
I'm Ira Melman, along with Jim Stevenson with VOA Global. One thing we didn't get to as far as the business was concerned, Google is announcing its matching monetary donations that its users make to fight Ebola with a new fundraising campaign. They launched it on Monday, the first matching campaign the company's ever announced.
We've got a big winner in the Country Music Awards and sports next.
In sports, Stan Wawrinka received a much-needed confidence boost with a victory over Thomas Berdych on Monday in his opening round-robin match at the ATP Tennis Finals in London. Chris Bowers has our report.
There's a danger when you get the world's top eight players playing at the same tournament that all matches can be very close. Not this one. Stan Wawrinka beat Thomas Berdych 6-1, 6-1 in just 58 minutes, a demolition job that's not supposed to happen when the world number four faces the world number seven. Up to a point, it was a case of Wawrinka's momentum that Berdych was unable to stop. The Swiss broke in a close second game, broke to love in the fourth, and by the time he broke for a third time early in the second set, Berdych was starting to think the gods were just against him. Wawrinka looked relaxed from the start, but the ease with which he read the big Czech's booming serve made a massive difference, and by the end, Wawrinka could do no wrong, while Berdych could do no right. The second match of the second day sees the Wimbledon champion Novak Djokovic take on the US Open champion Marin Cilic in a Serbia-Croatia battle between two genuinely good friends. Chris Bowers for VOA Sports, London.
Cricket's World Cup trophy will be shared by the finalists in 2015 if there is a tie or no result, after the sports governing body decided to scrap the use of a super over for the showpiece match. The International Cricket Council decided there will also be no super oval, or super over, that is. They do have an oval in cricket, to settle the quarterfinals or semifinals. It said the teams that finish the highest in the groups will advance.
Boston Red Sox manager, this is baseball, John Farrell, is looking forward to seeing Japanese pitching sensation Shohei Ohtani during Major League Baseball's All-Star postseason tour of Japan. Farrell and 29 Major League players arrived in Osaka Sunday night ahead of their five-game series against Japan starting Wednesday. The Major League Baseball All-Stars will also play two exhibition games during the tour.
Olympic women's figure skating champion Adelina Sotnikova will be missing the season's remaining Grand Prix events with an ankle ligament tear. Her leg is in plaster following a training injury Thursday. She will no longer be able to compete in the NHK Trophy in Japan. That's a Grand Prix event.
Isaiah Thomas scored 15 of his 22 points as Phoenix beat the Golden State Warriors. That's a look at sports.
Time for music on VOA Global. You know, what everyone in country music is now talking about is the just-announced Country Music Association Awards. And what everyone is talking about is one name, Miranda Lambert, who led the winners of the 48th Annual Country Music Association Awards. Her four wins included Single of the Year for Automatic, Musical Event of the Year for her duet with Keith Urban, We Were Us, Album of the Year for Platinum, and her fifth consecutive Female Vocalist of the Year. She now bids for the record for receiving the most female vocalist CMA awards, passing Reba McEntire and Martina McBride. Unfortunately, Miranda Lambert didn't win the biggest award of the night. Entertainer of the Year, that went to Luke Bryan.
Well, here now is Miranda Lambert's winning single, Automatic.
watching sun tea in the window, pocket watch, a tale in time. Seems like only yesterday I'd get a blank cassette, record the country countdown, cause I couldn't buy it yet. If we drove all the way to Dallas just to buy an Easter dress, we'd take along a Rand McNally, stand in line to pay for gas. God knows the shifting gears ain't what it used to be. I learned to drive that 55 just like a queen, three on a tree.
Automatic by Miranda Lambert, the big winner at the 48th Annual Country Music Association Awards. That's music on VOA Global, which you can hear every day at this time, and we hope you continue to tune in. Jim Stevenson, along with Ira Melman on VOA Global.
Now, let's continue on music. Now, it's a finding that's sure to ignite debates among music lovers around the world, certainly as far as I'm concerned. They've identified what they call the catchiest song of all time. Here is the winner.
Yo!
You gotta be kidding. That's the 1996 Spice Girls hit Wannabe. So say researchers from the University of Amsterdam. They work with the Museum of Science and Industry in Manchester in Great Britain to figure out why some songs are catchy and others are not. So what they did, they played a whole bunch of tunes, and people recognized this tune in an average of 2.29 seconds. However, Here are some of the runners-up, and I think there are a lot more.
Oh, there are a lot more. Oh, yeah. Behind the Spice Girls' Wannabe, it was Lou Bega, Mambo No. 5, Survivor, Eye of the Tiger, Lady Gaga, she, of course, had to be on the list.
Of course.
Just Dance, ABBA, SOS, that's one from our era, back in the 70s. Roy Orbison, even before that, Pretty Woman. Michael Jackson, remember him? Of course you do. Beat It was number 7.
You have to recognize that immediately.
Yeah, Whitney Houston, I Will Always Love You, The Human League, Don't You Want Me, coming in at number 10, Aerosmith, I Don't Want to Miss a Thing.
Lady Gaga, Poker Face, Hanson and Mbop, Elvis Presley, It's Now or Never, and Bachman Turner Overdrive, You Ain't Seen
Wow, BTO, yet. Some Canadian influence there.
I think it's all generational.
It must be.
That's going to do it for us. Our thanks to Tracy Carter, our director, Dina Abdul-Rahman, our technical director, and the boss, Diane Gallo.
We thank you for listening to VOA Global.